The words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Well, today's the third Sunday in Advent, and historically, in many places, the third Sunday of Advent is called Gaudete Sunday. For you Great Heart students, you know that's a second person plural imperative from the verb for to rejoice. So we focus on the third Sunday of Advent on joy. We're told to rejoice. Interestingly enough, the imperative to rejoice is given more than 100 times in the Bible. And that makes me think two things. One, that it's important, and B, that it's sometimes hard to do, or else why would God say it over and over and over again? So this morning, I'd like to look at what it means to rejoice. What does it mean to rejoice, and how do we do it? And in order to do that, I'd like to reflect on the psalm that we heard sung just a couple of minutes ago, Psalm 126. And Psalm 126 is part of a group of psalms, so Psalms 120 to Psalms 134, that are called the Psalms of Ascent. In Hebrew, there's a subscription that just says a song of ascent. And most scholars believe that these were psalms that were sung in pilgrimage on the way to the temple. And so when pilgrims were going to the Jerusalem temple three times a year, according to the Old Testament, all Jewish men were required to go to the temple, but it was common for people to go on pilgrimage to the temple. And it's again thought that these psalms were the psalms that were sung because you always go up to Jerusalem. So we're ascending to the temple, we're making pilgrimage, and as we go, we're going to sing these songs. And so this psalm, again, Psalm 126, it deals with the themes that we've talked about for the last couple of weeks, the themes of exile and return from exile. So you can think about this psalm in that light. Again, the people going into exile, the people returning from exile. But you can also think about it in terms of pilgrimage. Think what it was like for a pilgrim in ancient Israel to go to the temple. And so this psalm, again, 126, can be divided into two sections, the first part and the second part. Again, it's printed in your bulletin if you want to look at it. The first line, we learn a lot about what is going on here. When the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, then were we like those who dream. So again, talking about a specific event, likely the return from exile, when the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion. But it's important to note that this phrase, restoring the fortunes, is not simply a matter of our luck changed or our circumstances changed or we worked hard and something good happened. When the Lord restores one's fortunes, again, according to the Old Testament, what's gone on is we used to be under God's judgment, and now we're under God's favor. In other words, this is an action of God. We're celebrating and remembering the action of God in taking us again from being under judgment. Remember, we went into exile because we were rebellious. We broke God's covenant. We were disobedient to God's intention for us. So he judged us, and we're now in exile. And then when the exiles returned, it was like they were now under God's favor. The time of judgment was over. So restoring the fortunes of Zion was much more than our luck changed or circumstances changed. God did something remarkable. And so then we get into this idea of rejoicing. Because the Lord restored their fortunes, they were like those who dream. But then their mouth was filled with laughter and their mouth with songs of praise or shouts of joy. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie based on that Umberto Eco book called The Name of the Rose. If you've read the book, I think there's a special place in heaven for you if you made it through that thing. But nevertheless, the movie it was very well done. It's a set in a medieval monastery, and it's a mystery. And you find out, and I'm totally giving away the ending here, but you find out that this monk in the monastery was so focused on finding every reference to laughter in Aristotle's book on poetics and expunging it because he believed laughter to be a sin. Now, sometimes Christians can behave as though we believe that, actually, that laughing might be inappropriate, that shouting for joy might be inappropriate. Does God actually like it when we laugh? Does God like it when we shout for joy? And so I think, again, I don't know what that's like for you, but it seems to me that if we believe that God created our bodies in such a way to respond to positive stimuli with laughter, to respond to positive things with shouts of joy, then it's probably okay to do that. And especially when we see God, again, we're talking about God's action here, when we see God act in such a good and beautiful way, what else will we do but laugh and shout for joy? In other words, it's okay for Christians to do that. Now, some of us are more introverted, and so when we experience joy and we experience pleasure, maybe just a little crack of a smile pops up on our face, and that's how you know that we're experiencing joy. But I've learned over the years as an introvert that not everybody's wired like me. And that some people, when they're boisterous in laughing or when they shout for joy, they're not doing it simply to get attention. They're not doing it because they're insecure. That's something that I made up because I'm insecure. So all that to say that when God does something extraordinary, when God does something beautiful, it's completely appropriate to respond with manifestations of joy, like laughter and like loud shouts. So what I'm saying is, go for it. When we experience God's goodness in our midst, that's a totally appropriate response. Don't be like the medieval monk in Umberto Eco's story and try to pretend that laughter is somehow a sin. It's not. God created our bodies to respond like that for a reason, especially when we're remembering something that God has done that's so good and so powerful and so beautiful. So the first part of the psalm remembers God's action, God's action by which he showed favor to his people. And we're talking about the response of the people, laughter, shouts of joy. And what is the result of this? We see in the third verse that it was known among the nations that God had restored the fortunes. And so there's an evangelistic impulse here that when God acts on behalf of his people and they respond with joy, then the nations around take note. The God of Israel has done something powerful. The God of Israel has done something beautiful. The God of Israel has done something good to God's people. And so they take note. And that's, of course, God's intention for Israel when he called Abraham and said that in you all the nations of the world will be blessed. And so he commissioned Abraham and Abraham's descendants to be a blessing to the nations around them. The idea was that the nations around Israel would see them behaving in such a way and would see them interacting with God in such a way that they too would be drawn to the one true God. And so when we respond to God's activity in our life with laughter and with joy, then our neighbors begin to take note. What's going on there? What's happening there? What's happening in the midst of this people? What's going on in the midst of this people? And they too might see and know and come to worship and serve the one true God. So verse 4 is the center of the psalm. This verse 4 sums up what is going on in the psalm. The Lord has done great things for us, and we are glad indeed. And that phrase that's translated, we are glad indeed, is usually translated, and we rejoiced greatly, or something like that. So again, back to the theme of joy, back to the theme of rejoicing. And so they're remembering God's action on their behalf, God's mighty action on their behalf. They're responding with laughter. They're responding with shouts of joy. The nations are taking note of what God's doing among them. And then they sum it up by saying, the Lord has done great things for us, and we are glad indeed, or we rejoiced. But then notice what happens in verse 5. The tense begins to shift. Now they're not saying the Lord restored our fortunes, but they're asking God to restore their fortunes. And this, again, we've talked about this in the last couple of weeks, but the experience of the exiles when they returned to the Holy Land was less than enthusiastic because they were, on one hand, very glad to be home from Babylon. They were no longer enslaved in Babylon. They were no longer under the power of the king of Babylon. They were free. They were home. But what they were anticipating was God restoring their land to be like it was under David or under Solomon. And it was a far cry from that. And so they pray now. Lord, you restored our fortunes and we rejoiced. Now, Lord, will you restore our fortunes? Will you take us into that place of total and complete favor and blessing and abundance, that time that we're longing for? Lord, thank you for what you've done. Lord, will you continue to do what you have done even more so? And so again, you can see how the exiles who return could pray something like this, but you could also see how a pilgrim year to year going on pilgrimage to Jerusalem could pray this, because there's this event, the return from exile, which was significant, and they're remembering that. But everybody in their own lives probably experiences really good things every year, and they are aware of needs that they have every year, or struggles that they have every year, or things that are hard every year. And so you can, with complete integrity, pray, Lord, thank you for restoring my fortune. Lord, restore my fortune, you see, because we live in this tension between the goodness that God has already displayed and shown us and the goodness that we're yet to experience, the goodness for which we continue to long. And so the psalm ends with a prayer. And in the text today that you see printed in your bulletin, it's not so much printed like a prayer. Those who sowed with tears will reap with songs of joy, right? So a first century Jew would have known this agrarian imagery. People around the world today, most of whom continue to farm, would be familiar with this imagery as well. But what they're doing is pointing their attention toward the future. This will happen. Even though we may be crying on our way to the temple this year, we believe that these tears that we're sowing will one day become joy. And again, this reminds us of other psalms, like Psalm 32, where he says, though weeping may spend the night, joy comes in the morning. So there's this experience, again, that the person of faith has, that when we are going through things that are hard, going through things that we're struggling with, we're weeping, we're not denying that. We're not saying, on one hand, I just told you that you ought to laugh and shout for joy more often. But at the same time, the experience of a Christian person is one that knows great sorrow and is familiar with great sorrow and experiences deep pain and very real suffering. And so the tears come, and they should come. I think that we probably, especially in our culture, we probably ought to cry more than we do, because there's real pain and there's real sorrow and there's real suffering in the world. But what the psalmist is believing here, as they're going again on pilgrimage to the temple, preparing to worship, is that it will be turned to joy. That God will ultimately restore the fortunes of his people, and that this return from exile will become a signpost on the way to something greater. And so as Christians, we believe that when Jesus died and rose from the dead, that God was inaugurating, really beginning this new creation, that God was beginning the process of making all things new. And so when we as Christian people sing this psalm, say this psalm, we remember that. When did the Lord take us from being under his judgment to being objects of favor? Well, it was on the cross when Jesus endured and absorbed the punishment for our sin, the penalty for our sin, the consequences of our sin. And now we're signs and objects of God's favor. So the Lord has restored our fortune. We can pray this and say this with integrity. Having said that, We live in the world, and in the world, there's pain. In the world, there's sorrow. In the world, there's suffering. In the world, we shed tears. And that's part of the story as well. But because of what God has done in the past in and through Jesus, we have every confidence that he will one day fulfill all of that. And so the tears will be turned to joy. I was reminded as I was preparing the sermon of Jesus' words to the disciples in John 16. Now, scholars have said that John 14 through 16, Jesus' upper room discourse, he's with the disciples, he's just about to die, and he's preparing them for his departure. And listen to what he says to his disciples. This is verses 20 to 24. "Very truly I tell you, you will weep and mourn, but the world will rejoice. You will have pain, but your pain will turn into joy. When a woman is in labor, she has pain because her hour has come. But when her child is born, she no longer remembers the anguish because of the joy of having brought a human being into the world. So you have pain now, but I will see you again, and your hearts will rejoice, and no one will take your joy from you. And on that day, you will ask nothing of me. Very truly, I tell you, if you ask anything of the Father in my name, he will give it to you. Until now, you have not asked for anything in my name. Ask and you will receive, so that your joy may be complete." So you see that Jesus, with his disciples, the night before he dies, is preparing them to experience joy. And I don't believe that Jesus is telling his disciples here, look, tomorrow, Good Friday is going to be sad. Sunday, you're going to be happy, and you're going to be happy the rest of your life. But he's telling them that the reality of sorrow and the reality of pain will be turned into joy. And watch how this works. I'm going to show you how this works. Begin to trust that this is happening. So Eugene Peterson wrote a book several years ago on the Psalms of Ascent. And he called it A Long Obedience in the Same Direction, which is funny because that's a line from Friedrich Nietzsche's book, Beyond Good and Evil. Wherever Nietzsche is, I hope he gets a kick out of that, that Christians around the world know this line of one of his books in which he was arguing against Christianity. But nevertheless, when Peterson's talking about this specific psalm, he has a great image, and he talks about people who are struggling to experience joy in the present. They're going through something really hard. They're struggling with something, one thing or another. They're experiencing pain in one way or another. It's like, okay, Lord, I know you want me to have joy. I know because of what you've done in Jesus, I ought to have joy, but I'm just not feeling it. And Eugene Peterson says, sometimes we have to borrow joy from the future. Borrow joy from the future. I don't know if that image helps you, but it helps me a lot. Because I know what's going to happen in the future. I know that all things will be made new. I know that creation will be renewed and restored. And I don't experience it all now. But knowing that the future exists how it does, then I can ask God to give me some of that joy, that future joy, that I might know that future joy even now in the present. And so it could be that this morning you're here and you have a very strong sense of the reality of the resurrection of Jesus, and you're experiencing that joy that only God can bring. And so I want you to experience it and share it with us. But it could be you're in a season in life and a struggle and a season of suffering, of confusion, disorientation in one way or another. I wonder what it would look like for you to ask God, God, I don't feel it right now. I don't experience this joy of Jesus' resurrection right now. But I wonder if you could give me some from the future. I can't experience it in the present because of everything that's going on in my life. But I know what's coming. And so I wonder if you could show me a little bit of joy. Borrow some joy from the future. And so as we continue to worship, as we continue to pray, as we gather around the Lord's table, know that the Lord in Jesus has indeed restored our fortunes, even as we ask him to restore our fortunes. Amen.